that you and yours have a wonderful Easter. And for those listening, the same sentiments. How did everything go for you this past weekend?
We had a wonderful, wonderful weekend. Got to spend time with family and friends, and it was just a good weekend.
Very good. Okay. How about storm damage after last night's big storm that ripped through?
None at my house. Very thankful, none at my house.
Yeah. So. We missed any storm damage, but I have to tell you, at 11 o'clock last night, that wind was really... They talked about 80-mile-an-hour winds.
Wow.
I think it probably happened.
I would not be surprised.
So I certainly hope that everyone listening didn't have any storm damage. That's not a good way to start the week, for sure.
Yeah, we did have some reports in Quail Creek of limbs down and across Fairhope.
Yeah.
There were some...
Well, we'll see how the damage goes, but I certainly hope that everyone listening, had the same good luck that we had, no damage at all, and I think that's the outcome we're looking for.
Yes.
So, now, back to the news issue that Mark says we want to talk about news. Well, why do we want to talk about news? Because a lot of news is happening, and as usual, there's an overwhelming amount to try to fit into a half an hour, but I will do my best.
Okay.
And see what we can highlight here and move in a direction that gives you a little bit more of an understanding of some of these issues, at least from a conservative perspective. Okay. So in order to do that, let me just say this. I want to go back and talk a little bit more about Ukraine as I did last week. I think it's important that we understand what's going on and what's taking place and what is going to happen if certain things take place. Meaning, you've got Putin saying there are going to be consequences you don't think about if you continue to supply the Ukrainians. Oh, okay. What does that really mean? We need to kind of mull that over. I also want to talk about aspects of a more forward-leaning defense strategy, which means that the Ukrainians can defend themselves without us having to do no-fly zones and things like that, which I would argue, and I've said this already, I think a no-fly zone is just too much because it's going to involve us, shooting down Russian planes and going after their anti-aircraft system. So I don't think a no-fly zone is something we need, okay? What the Ukrainians do need is the capability to shoot down all those Russian planes and to intercept missiles. And I understand they did intercept some missiles going into Lviv last night. That's good news, but why is it that some missiles got through? I'm sorry. This is where the Iron Dome issue becomes, I think, relevant. And I've talked about this before. The Iron Dome is what the Israelis and the U.S. developed, and you've seen how effective it is in Israel. And I think that's something that needs to be brought, and we'll talk more about that in just a minute. I also want to talk a little bit about what's going on in the border. I think it's important for us to understand, like we just found out that there have been over, I think, 23 terrorists, known terrorists, that have been captured coming across the border. I mean, along with the 220,000 people who are coming in, and the poor Border Patrol, they're overwhelmed.
Of course.
I mean, we don't have a border under control at all. I do think that the Elon Musk issue is something that we need to just touch on because, again, we've all complained about Twitter banning people. It's all ideologically motivated. Well, what Elon Musk is doing, I mean, last week, he talked about, or no, 2 weeks ago, he talked about buying 9% of the stock and maybe going on the board of directors. Then that went away, and now he's just talking about buying the whole damn thing. I mean, that would be interesting, and that would drive the liberal left crazy if they lost the ability to just, wipe people off of Twitter because they don't like what they're saying. So it's a real First Amendment case that I think we need to just talk a little bit about. If I can, I do want to talk a little bit about what's going on, in state issues that we have. And I think last week I didn't get to any of them. So this week I'm determined we're going to hit a couple of the bills that were passed, and we'll see what we get with that. So let's continue our discussion of Ukraine, okay? I do think that the impact of the Bucha atrocities is something that needs to be developed a little bit more fully, okay? On the one hand, prior to discovering these atrocities, yes, NATO was willing to help and doing whatever they needed to do, sending materials and blah, blah, blah. But with the atrocities, it seems like that NATO has gotten itself to the point where it really is serious now about imposing sanctions, okay? And the sanctions regime that they talked about doing, while okay, didn't go far enough. I mean, if the Russians are able to get $1.8 billion a day out of their energy sector to fund the war, then it's obvious that something's wrong there. And so the atrocities now have given moral courage to go beyond just what we've seen so far. And I think it's important that we understand that, because here again, if Putin is able to fund this war or whatever else he wants to do, then, I mean, it's not going to be good, because he'll just continue to do what he's done in Ukraine and other places. However, if we can send a strong enough signal, you know, both diplomatically, militarily, and this economic side of it, then it seems like there's a possibility that you can actually deter future forays into, you know, against the sovereignty of some of these Baltic states and other places around there too. So, yeah.
Well, this isn't the first time that Putin has invaded other countries. This is really the first time that the world has stood up and said, that's enough.
Well, exactly. And I think that's the point, too, in terms of deterrence theory. Okay? He got away with it in 2008 into South Ossetia, in the state of Georgia. He got away with it in Crimea and in 2014, and then he got away with it again in this whole business of the eastern Ukraine, where they've set up two separatist states. And I think that, you know, if we are going to say that we need to be able to deter him from doing that in other states that he wants, because he's claiming already that they've got Russian-speaking people and we've got to defend them, okay? Well, that's just code for, we're going in there and we're going to take care of this. Now, how again, historically, deterrence usually works if you present your foe with a real-world consequence that they just don't want to have to deal with. Now, I mean, Biden and them kept saying they don't want to impose sanctions before they invaded. They want to, you know, hope that the knowledge that these sanctions would be imposed would be sufficient to prevent Putin from doing something. Well, that didn't work. So going forward, what are we going to do? Repeat the last thing? I hope not. So my point here, though, is that even when Biden and them imposed their sanctions, it looked strong, but it really wasn't. And as such, what are the consequences for Putin? I mean, his energy is still bringing in $1.8 billion a day. The Germans have finally discovered that maybe we don't want to be dependent upon Russian gas. And so, you know, they have walked away from the Nord Stream pipeline. I mean, that's a major event. And one can argue that unless we see that kind of moral courage and a willingness to pay a price for being dependent upon Ruski gas, then we're not going to be able to do anything unless people are willing to pay that price. Okay, so here's the price. Russian oil, you know, is on the global market. That market is extremely high right now for the cost of oil. You hear Biden talking about the Putin inflation. That's only partially correct, obviously, because the inflation in gas prices and in oil rising was all related to the first day that Biden came into office. What did he do? Canceled the Keystone Pipeline, shut down Anwar development, which Trump had laid both of those things moving in the right direction. That created a supply problem immediately. Okay, so, I mean, Biden can scream and yell to the highest levels that that you know, it's all Putin inflation. It's not, and everyone knows that. But my point here is that if Putin gets away with this, okay, then whatever the outcome of Ukraine is, if that outcome does not support deterrence theory, then why in the world should Putin blink about doing it again somewhere else? Exactly.
Exactly.
I mean, so it's one of these things where there's a lot at stake here, and it's not just the Ukrainian sovereignty. It's the degree to which the world itself has to be able to take the measure of what Putin is doing and come up with policies that allow for a positive outcome, meaning that world order can be preserved because the other actors in these various states are going to abide by, at least if not international law, which is an oxymoron in many ways, as we're seeing today, okay? But we're also going to be playing by certain rules that say just because you're the stronger doesn't mean you could go take whatever country you want. That's the rationale we used against Saddam Hussein when he took Kuwait. You know, George Bush said, we cannot allow this to stand. If we do, world order will go away. Now, we can argue about, you know, who gets to make world order decisions. I get that. But on the other hand, it seems to me that you're either going to go back to the 30s, where world order was in fact destroyed by the aggressor nations, Japan and Italy and Germany, or we're going to try to recreate the post-Cold War world order, which I would argue presided over one of the best periods of world history, because there was very little, you know, major conflict. Material benefits accrued to lots of people. 300 million Chinese came out of poverty, and close to that number in India. Why was that? Because world order allowed for freer trade, the expansion of capitalism into some of these countries that hadn't been capitalistic inclined, China being one of them, India being another. So you have a situation where there's a lot riding on what the outcome of this is and what lessons Putin is going to take away from it. So let's just kind of move to a lower level, okay? We want that outcome to be positive. We want him to understand that further aggression is not going to work, okay? So what we have in our quiver here are the arrows of economic sanctions.
Okay.
We have the arrow of possible military support for people who are under threat, okay? But we also have a major arrow in terms of being able to unite around the NATO countries and provide them with the support they need to defend themselves, but going one step further. It means deploying NATO forces into these targeted areas. Now, we already have about 2,500 U.S. forces. I think it's in Latvia. We've got about 20,000 in Poland, okay? So what's happening is a forward deployment. And this is, and the argument here is, if you remember during the Cold War, we basically said, you know, our forward deployments into Germany and NATO and all like that, that was a trigger point, okay? So that if the Russians decided they wanted to invade one day, then they would be met by U.S. forces, and that would trigger a major response, okay? Mm-hmm. The argument here is we can't have a trigger. What we need is sufficient forces on the ground to deter and defeat a Russian invasion. What do I mean? Very simply this. Look at what happened when Russia tried to take Kiev. They had their noses bloodied badly. They couldn't do it. And that's exactly what we have to be able to say will happen in the Baltic states, in Moldova, in Poland. Okay? So again, the architecture for this is similar to what we've been doing, except we have to make sure that if Putin decides that he wants to cross into the Baltic states, he's going to have a bloody nose, a very bloody nose, that will allow us then to get more forces there to make sure that he can't reach his goals. That's what I would argue is the difference between, you know, a trigger point and a defensive system that really is defensive in nature, and that means that these people can count on surviving, just as the Ukrainians did. Now, again, you notice what's happened with Ukraine. I mean, they have been devastated in many of their cities, Mariupol and all the rest of them. But notice, too, that they have resisted to the point where they have been successful keeping the Ruskies out. And I do think that that's the issue that makes sense to me in terms of future deterrence, okay? So that arrow that we have in the quiver of being strong on the ground to protect these people, that's something I think we've got to contemplate. And I'm hoping that's where this will go. We shall see, as with everything else that goes on, okay? But I do think that, you know, if we can create a major roadblock in front of Putin, then it seems to me that we will be moving in the direction that we need to reestablish a coherent world order, that it may not be perfect, but at least it makes him stop to think twice about going forward.
Well, yes, and it has to be something that he can recognize as a roadblock, because if he has sanctions on his people and his people are inconvenienced, he doesn't care.
Right.
And if he has sanctions placed on him where his people end up starving, he doesn't care. He's almost another Stalin in many ways.
Well, that's exactly the problem. He doesn't care. Now, there may come a point, though, where the Soviet Union had food riots in 1962, okay? And they had to suppress it. And it sent shockwaves through the Communist Party. I would argue that something as extreme as food riots could get Putin's attention, okay? Because the fabric of society can unravel very quickly. Now, whether or not those kinds of things take place remain to be seen. But again, go back to what Biden and them have argued all along, that they were going to destroy the Russian economy, and they were doing it, you know, through the sanctions system and all like that. So far, that hasn't happened, but then they didn't go far enough in terms of just cutting off the Russian oil. And again, I go back to what I said earlier, it's only after the atrocities were discovered that the West has suddenly gotten the moral backbone to confront its dependence on Russian oil. And as such, it could mean that we would finally use the one sanction that would definitely hurt him and could lead to the kind of rioting, you know, if the economy in Russia really collapses. We'll see how that goes. But I do think that it's important for us to kind of think about how we want to see this all play itself out. And I would argue at this point, when you see our ability to help the Ukrainians sink a Russian ship in the Black Sea, that's what we need to be able to do. If we see more of the abilities to be able to shoot down the Russian ballistic missiles and more shooting down their jet bombers and things like that, that to me is what gives us an edge in terms of creating for Putin a situation where he knows he can't win. Now, this certainly hinges on what takes place on the ground in the East. And that's where the next big move is going to be, as I think we've seen that the Ruskies are trying to move more people out there to outflank the Ukrainians, come in behind them and all like that. Once more, we see that the Ukrainians are fully capable of defending themselves. And so what we can do to facilitate their defense in the East, is something that I think has to be thought through carefully, because like I said, I don't think a no-fly zone will help, but I do think trying to get them more, you know, Patriot missiles, get the Iron Dome. I mean, I know it's an issue with the Israelis because they developed this with us, so they have a say in this. But on the other hand, it seems to me that, you know, that the Israelis now, I think, are coming to realize that just because they have to work with the Russians over being able to go after Iranian positions in Syria, they also see that it's a two-edged sword and that the Russians don't necessarily have to be, you know, consulted on this because the Israelis have the ability to defend themselves. And so once that realization takes place, and once the realization is that the Iranians are their main worry, and it seems to me that that's when the Israelis might be willing to start looking at deploying the Iron Dome into Ukraine. We'll see. But I think it's absolutely critical for the outcome that we want to see the Ukrainians get all of the defensive capabilities that are necessary. And it should happen sooner rather than later, particularly if the Russians are going to start targeting places like Lviv. And again, I think there was a bombing in Kiev too, which has been pretty much free from all of that. But here again, we get back to, you know, the basics of self-defense and the ability for the Ukrainians to be able to do that. And if they can't do it, then we need to fix that. You know, that's my theory on that. And again, if we fix that, then Putin can't get his end game. And I think that's what we have to be, you know, pushing towards. And to a degree, we are. I mean, if they have another $800 million worth of military goods going, okay, fine. But, you know, how much more do they need? How much more, you know, can we get as quickly as possible? Particularly with this Russian offensive going over in the east, I think it is important for us to do that. So, this discussion about the Ukrainian thing, I know last week I spent a lot of time on it, and here we are again. It's now, you know, 29 after. Yeah. I mean, it goes so fast. But let me just talk about a couple of other things before we run out of time completely, okay? The question about the border, once again, okay? They're talking about 221,000 have already come across this past month, okay? I mean, where does this end? And it's open-ended unless the Democrats decide that it's so much of an issue for them that they'll take some steps to stop it. But there's no incentive for them on this.
Yeah, I don't see them doing.
I mean, it's all to the good. They're getting all the brown-colored people, which is basically their idea. They want to, you know, make this country less white. Okay. The interesting thing, though, is that even though the folks who are coming across are not white necessarily, they may not have all the values that the Democrats, the woke Democrats, think they have. So that could be a political issue down the road. But the point is, this is all illegal. Okay? So whatever political orientation these people have coming across the border doesn't matter. What matters is the Democrats are responsible for it. And this business of fentanyl, 100,000 people have died, and the Chinese are sending the fentanyl through Mexico, coming right across the border. They're directly responsible. It seems to me that Trump was trying to put pressure on the Chinese with tariffs and all like that to get them to stop that. These people here in Washington now, Biden, they have done nothing to stop this.
No, they don't care.
And they don't care, okay? What they want is their goal to bring more illegals across to change the political dynamics of the United States. And that's it. So once again, we get back to November of this year being a critical year for, you know, the United States as we know it to regain control of its own destiny on the border. I mean, it's such a no-brainer. I mean, Mark, I can't even believe that we have to sit here and say stuff like this. but it's happening. And unless the Republicans take over, and unless they have the guts to do what's necessary, as Trump did, you know, then nothing will change.
Well, even President Obama, I didn't agree with everything that he did or not did. But one thing that I will say in his favor is he exported.
He got rid of more
illegals than all other presidents combined. So he, even as liberal a Democrat as he was, he was for a strong border and a strong America.
Well,
so if a Democrat can take that kind of stance, then why aren't these?
Yeah. Well, you see, the thing about it is that Obama's catch and release program was part of what he did, okay? And catch and release meant that these people were released into the states, okay? But he also, they changed the rules on the borderline, and so when people came across that weren't asylum seekers, mm-hmm. then they were sent back over. So the statistics, you know, started to show an improvement like you mentioned, okay? But the real issue was these asylum seekers, and that's what Trump, you know, came to see, that catch and release was a disaster. And so he worked it out with the Mexicans. Okay, you're caught, you're sent back to Mexico, you await for the adjudication of your asylum claim, and you'll wait in Mexico.
And Mexico started having stricter rules, right, on their border, their southern border, to keep,
exactly,
people out, because they didn't want all these people just coming and hanging out in Mexico waiting to get in the United States.
Exactamente. Okay, so you have, you know, now the situation where it's just out of control. And the Mexicans, I mean, we've seen pictures of the Mexican police getting overrun by these caravans. Now, you know, I mean, it seems to me like a little wall down there might help, you know. Maybe that's a thought, but that ain't going to happen either.
Mm-hmm. And so, that's the Mexican police being overrun. So, yeah
it
not
is.
The U.S. police.
But it's one of these things that I think, you know, all in all, this border business is not just about the flood coming in. It's everything else with it. And I think that, you know, when 23 terrorists are caught, when you see, I mean, I can't remember exactly the number we're talking about, but there have been hundreds of people who were, you know, murderers, gang members, you know, felons of all sorts, who were, some of whom were thrown out of here years ago and they've come back. On top of the fact that, and again, this happens to be correct, you know, thousands of Americans are victims of their crimes. You know, hundreds have been killed. You know, so I think that it is a real issue, along with the big crime issue which we won't talk about, mm-hmm. today. So in let me just get this in about Elon Musk and what's going,
okay,
on with Twitter. I do think it's important. You know, it will drive a stake in the heart of the woke attempts to suppress free speech if Elon Musk can take over Twitter, whether it's alone or in conjunction with partners and all like that. So that seems to be where he's going this time, not just going to be a 9% stakeholder, not going to sit on the board because that would have constrained what he could do and say. So he's just going to outright buy it for about $40 billion. I mean, it's amazing, isn't it?
Yeah, that anybody has that much money.
But he can afford it, I guess. He's got about $150 billion, you know, in various assets. But here's a guy who is going to stand up for free speech. And we need this free speech to be defended because, as it stands right now, the media and others are just willing to wipe away any speech that they do not agree with. And that's not American, and we've got to fight it. And I hope Elon Musk is successful with it.
Yeah, that gets back to the First Amendment, the right to free speech. So,
yeah.
And
they don't care about that. I mean, what's the First Amendment? Come on. And the Second Amendment. Forget that, too.
Yeah.
You know? So.
And the Second Amendment protects the First and all the rest.
All the rest. All right. Well, Mark, certainly great to see you today. Glad we had a chance to visit and carry on a conversation about these issues. For those of you, I just want to just let everybody know. Go ahead, Mark.
Did you want to go ahead and touch on the state of Alabama things that you had?
No, I'll wait till next week.
Okay.
I don't want to, you know, Lori is good about giving me a few extra minutes, so we're okay with it. I do want to let everyone know that on this coming Saturday, the 23rd of April, from 11 in the morning until 2 in the afternoon, Common Sense Campaign is having its annual Tax Day rally. Hey guys, if you haven't noticed, it is Tax Day, so you better get your stuff in. But be that as it may, our Tax Day rally will be at Fowl River Community Center. If you'll just go to our website, commonsensecampaign.org, you'll have a flyer up there with directions on how to get out there. 11 o'clock on Saturday, and it's a fish fry, so come enjoy, okay? Y'all have a great week. God bless. Take care. Bye.
Listen for the Conservative Watchdog Weekly News Review, paid talk show, Monday mornings at 10:05 with Dr. Lou Campomanosi.
It's nuts. It's not science. It is just politics, and that's all it is.
Listen live online or on the radio, or pull it up later on our new website, WABF1480.com.